Group Captain Eccles, Rail 8. Now, we were talking about your time out in command of two independent flights in India, the 1300 Met flight and the 1581 radar calibration flight. How did you get on with the officers? I'm quite interested because you were only a young lad yourself. I mean, 23 possibly by then. I'm not perhaps even that. What was your sort of relationship with the men? You know, the officers and the men in your flights.
In the case of the Met calibration flight in Calcutta, I was much more concerned with the welfare of the men than I had been previously in England and Iceland. Because here we were much more on our own. And there wasn't much in the way of welfare problems. It was just a question of seeing that they got paid, got their allowances and so on. Because although these were autonomous units, which meant we were self-accounting, no administrative staff was provided, which meant that I had to do all my own administration, which included typing out all the necessary movement records so that people got all their pay. And it was quite an onerous task. I didn't know the first thing about this administration. I got hold of a manual of administration and worked on that. But anyway, in the end, everyone, because when I arrived, they were very much in arrears of pay, but we got it all sorted out and they were all very happy with the money they got. There were only two other officers on the unit. The rest of the air crew were all NCO air crew. And the three of us used to go around as if we were all chums together. There
wasn't really a barrier in rank?
Not at all. Anything but. We were just all out together. We went out to clubs and things in Calcutta rank never came into it.
Now, how did you get on with the local population? I presume you mainly mixed with the army.
Whilst I was in Calcutta and Bagachi, my activities were entirely restricted to mixing with military personnel. I didn't have any Indian colleagues at all. I had one. No, I didn't actually have any at all. And I knew a number of army people, and of course, when I went over to Camilla, I knew a number of the people there in her hospital and so on, but local population didn't really come into it.
Now, so what happens next then? What's your next...
After the Met flight and the calibration flight were re-equipped, and it was realised, in fact, that there were two units and only one CO, it was decided that both units would be given new COs and that I would now move on, particularly as I was approaching sufficient seniority to be considered for promotion to squadron leader. So I was posted to the at that time was the AXE Communications Squadron in New Delhi, ACSEA, the Air Command Southeast Asia Communications Squadron, which was based at Willingdon, RAF Willingdon, which had been the pre-war grass flying club airfield of New Delhi.
And what exactly were you doing there?
Well, before I got there, it was some distance, of course, from Calcutta, and I got my own aircraft, and it happened that one of my navigators was also posted to the unit, so the two of us flew up there in this aircraft, and I sent my bearer on by rail with my luggage, my tin trunk and so on. And of course, as I say, he was an extremely loyal, competent bearer, and he turned up on time in Delhi with all the equipment and no questions asked. When I reported in to the commanding officer of the communications squadron, because I was going as a flight commander in the squadron, I said to Paddy Towell, who was the CEO, what shall I do with my aircraft? And he said, what aircraft? I said, well, that silver Blenheim outside. And he said, God, he said, we can't keep that here. We've got to get rid of it. So unfortunately, it was got rid of. And it was sent off to an airfield in the middle of nowhere called Bakshi Katalab. B-A-K-S-H-I hyphen K-A hyphen T-A-L-E-B. And that was just a dump. It was full of aircraft, just taxied into the jungle and left to rot. All kinds of aircraft that were no longer required. The job I had at Willingdon turned out to be a most interesting one and gave me, again, a very comfortable war. I was... The unit was a communications squadron responsible for flying people around, staff officers and others, around India.
Is it part of Transport Command then? Or
no, it was part of Air Command Southeast Asia. And the squadron was of three flights. One flight was the Dakota flight. Second flight was the Beechcraft Expediter flight. And the third flight was the single-engine fly-yourself flight. Now, I was to be the flight commander of the Beechcraft Expediter flight. The squadron, we were also flying VIPs, and so we became VIP pilots. The squadron commander was, in fact, the Viceroy's personal pilot, and flight commander of the Dakotas was the CNC's personal pilot, Lord Lee. I was the personal pilot of the Countess of Carlisle, who was the head of all the women's services in India, the RINs, which was the Navy equivalent, the Indian equivalent of the RENs, the WACI, which was the equivalent of the ATS, and there was no Air Force equivalent.
This was Countess Carlisle?
Countess of Carlisle.
Now, what was she like?
She was a very pleasant person. I flew her all over India, taking her on many tours, fascinating tours, sometimes up in the front line with a Spitfire fighter escort, sometimes landing on polo grounds, staying with Maharajas, staying in hotels, covering the whole of India. Some of the flights I did were an enormous variety of flights of all kinds. I flew Maharajas around, I flew wing commanders around, I flew army officers around. I went on tours that lasted for a week or 10 days. And great was the variety of life, and it was... very much do it yourself and your own personal discipline.
What about the rest of your flight? I mean, you were flight commander. How did you control the rest of them?
Well, the when I was there, I would be responsible for allocating tasks. We would get from headquarters telephone calls for booking flights for whatever they were, sometimes just to take someone from A to B that day, and sometimes going away on a tour. When these bookings came in, there were no fixed times, they would just get phone calls. If I was in the office, then I would make the allocations of who was going to do them. If I was away on a flight, then my deputy flight commander would take over. And if he was away, then somebody else would take over. It was quite amazing, actually, the sort of things that went on. I was able to see quite a lot of my wife because I got quite a lot of flights down to the forward areas, and of course she was down there. I was with the Countess of Carlisle, invariably looked after by a lot of her officers in the 80, in the WACIs, were, in fact, either English or Indian ladies living in India before the war with their own houses. And so, for example, when I went to Calcutta, I invariably stayed with Mr. and Mrs. Kent in their beautiful house in Calcutta. There are many, of course, incidents I can think of. I'll tell you for one anecdote. I was taking the Countess of Carlisle on tour, and we were in Cochin in southern India, and we were visiting the Women's Royal Indian Navy, and of course the Royal Navy. And she was staying in one hotel with her PA, and I was staying with my navigator in another hotel. And we were all invited to a cocktail party by the station commander of the Fleet Air Arm airfield at Cochin. And we arrived for this party and had a wonderful party. It was great fun. And around about 8 o'clock, Countess Carlisle started making sounds like it was time for her to go. And as far as Les and I were concerned, the last thing we wanted to do was to go. But a couple of naval officers who were there heard what she was saying. They said, well, we're just going back to Cochin, so we'll take you in. She said, fine. So she and Sheila went off in their car. And apparently what happened was that on the way, and of course it was dark, and on the way into Cochin, a few miles, they said to her, had she ever been aboard an aircraft carrier? And she said, no, she hadn't. And they said, well, you know, you really ought to go aboard one, and there's one in port tonight. Now, port wasn't a port, it was just a bay, and the carrier was at anchor in the bay. So rather unable to talk her way out of it, off she went. And when they arrived in pitch darkness at the carrier, there was a rope ladder hanging down the side, and she had to climb up this rope ladder, and she was in her white uniform. On arriving at the wardroom, there was one hell of a party going on of the ship's officers, and immediately a gin was thrust in her hand, and very soon the chief engineer officer said to her, would she like to see the engine room? And she said, well, she'd very much like to, but this was the only uniform she had, and she was taking a parade first thing in the morning, she thought she'd better decline. And he said, well, take the bloody thing off. The captain overheard this conversation and realised that something had to be done. And she said, well, I think it's time I went anyway. And the two young officers that had brought her aboard said, well, they were very sorry, but the pinnace had broken down and they couldn't go. So she had to have another gin. And then she said, well, really, I'm going. And she climbed down the gangplank, and it really was being worked on, the pinnace. But anyway, she got into the pinnace and sat down in the stern with her arms folded. And the captain, realising what had happened, decided he'd better go and try and mollify her. So he came down a bit later down the rope ladder and missed his footing and fell in the sea. So it wasn't the happiest of visits. And on the way back to land, the pinnace broke down again in the middle of the bay, and they were striking matches and shouting help. When Les and I saw her PA next morning at about 6 a.m., because she was taking this parade and then off, we were going somewhere else, Sheila said to me, be careful how you speak to the old girl this morning, she's not in the best of moods. I discovered afterwards why.
Any other stories? That's a good story, you know, just the personal side of the people you were carrying. The Countess or any others?
Yes, there was an occasion in Srinagar where when I was in Calcutta, my wife and I had been able to get some leave and go off to Kashmir for a holiday, for a leave, which in itself was quite interesting, because when we arrived at the station in Calcutta to catch the train, which was a two-day journey or so to Lahore, where we had to change trains again, I booked seats, but there was no name of Eccles on any of the carriage windows, but a 100-rupee note, or whatever it was, a 10-rupee note maybe, was sufficient for the guard to cross out a name and put Eccles on, and we were all right. When we arrived in Lahore and had to change trains, had to go through the same situation again, But this time I thought, well, what the hell with this, I'll try the engine driver. So I went to the engine driver and suggested that there was no accommodation for me. And he said, oh, fair enough. And he unhooked the engine and went off and brought another carriage. And we had a complete carriage to ourselves, much to the annoyance of the guard, who didn't get any money out of it. And when we arrived at Rawalpindi to get up to Kashmir by taxi, we discovered that the road was down and there was no movement. However, it was eventually decided that the taxi would take us to where the road, the landfall had blocked the road, and we'd walk round the landfall and another taxi would be there to meet us the other side. So off we set. It was noted that on the rear wheel, one of the tyres had a big amount of cloth tied round it. It turned out that, in fact, there was a weakness in the tyre, and the driver put it there to reinforce the tyre. It didn't work. We got a flat tyre, but that eventually got sorted out. We arrived at the landslide and walked round it down. It was a bit tricky because it was quite a big fall down to the ravine at the bottom. And there was, in fact, a taxi waiting for us. But by this time, it was very late. And so we had to stay the night in a Dak bungalow, D-A-K bungalow, which was, I think, a sort of transit hut used pre-war for official travellers. It was very primitive and very much in need of tidying up. Anyway, we went on to Kashmir, and unfortunately, as we arrived in Kashmir, my wife went down with malaria. The time that we were there, we were on a houseboat, and we were suckers to go and put our money down for buying a sealskin fur coat for 1,000 rupees. As suckers, we didn't appreciate that the fact that there wasn't one immediately available and it would follow was part of the con. So anyway, our holiday was over, we went back, and eventually, some weeks or months later, the sealskin fur coat turned up. And it wasn't sealskin, it was rabbit, and it was very, very badly made. It was impossible to wear it. And obviously, the Indian who'd sold this to us knew full well that there would never be a comeback. But however, a year or so later, when I was on the comm squadron at Delhi, I was taking the Maharaja of Kashmir, into Srinagar, along with the political agent. The political agent had just been in Delhi to be knighted, and he was flying back, so I took the two of them. And I was telling the political agent about this situation that had happened, about the fur coat. And he said, oh, I'll look into this for you and see what can be done. And about a week or so later, as we were the next day leaving, the agent was there and said to me, look, I've seen that chap and here's your money, and gave it to me. I said, well, thank you very much. How did you do this? Well, he said it was quite simple. He said, I just said to the fellow that if he didn't pay up, I'd close his business down. And about a week later, I got the most humble letter from this man, the most grovelling letter that you could ever imagine, but it was all part of the way of life of an India at that time.
Now, we were just going through stories. Any other particular stories or individuals you recall?
Oh, gosh, yes, I can tell you so many. I'll tell you another one, then, about the Maharaja of Baroda. The Maharaja of Baroda had been in England on some business or other, and during the shortage of Spitfire aircraft in the earlier part of the war, when people had been asked to hand in their aluminium and everything else to help the Spitfire fund, the Maharaja made a very munificent donation, so much so that A Squadron was known as the Baroda Squadron. I was sent down to Karachi to pick him up on return from England. And the Maharaja Baroda, like a number of the Maharajas of India, was of course an extremely wealthy man and terribly much involved in horse racing on a very high level. Also that in every major city in India there was a Baroda house fully staffed, so that if he happened to be passing through he would have somewhere to go. And we were on the way to Baroda, night stopping in Bombay. And he invited Les and myself to have dinner with him that evening. So we went along to Baroda House in Bombay for dinner. And he was there with his chum, just the two of us, and to himself, the four altogether. And we went into the dining room, which was an enormous place with, a table that would seat about 30 or 40 people. And the four of us just sat at one end, having a very general chat. And I asked him, did he look up his squadron whilst he was in India, in England? And he said, yes, he did. He threw a party for them at the Dorchester. He said, I think they had a good time because Britt, who was his jockey, he said, said that when he went to his room, there were two or three characters passed out on the bed and one or two on the floor. He said, I think they had a good time. It cost me £1,000. Well, of course, £1,000 in those days was a large amount of money. He'd also just bought a yearling of a Derby winner, which eventually became called Sarji Rao, for some 20,000 guineas, which was a world record price. Whilst we were talking about this in Baroda House, Bombay, a bearer came up and whispered in his ear, and he said, excuse me, a phone call I put through to my wife has just come through, and I'm just going to take it. So off he went to take the telephone call. And when he came back, I said, was it a satisfactory call? He said, oh, yes, I got my full 3 minutes worth. When we got to, I think it was Gwalior, I'm not sure of the name of the airfield, we were just landing to refuel. The local Maharaja had heard that Baroda was on his way through. And so when we landed, we were given taxiing instructions to taxi to the far side of the airfield, where there was a marquee set up and a large carpet stretched out in front of it. And it was an open-ended marquee with a number of sort of tables full of all kinds of food and fruit and everything else and drinks. And as we got out of the aircraft, this visitor, the local Maharaja said to Baroda, he said, hello, Charlie, I heard you were coming through to refuel, and I wondered if you might like a snack whilst you were refueling, which we had, but it was an enormous amount of display that had gone on for this very brief stop. And when we got to Baroda, it was a weekend, and Les and I were put up in a sort of a hostel that he ran, a home that he ran for visitors, where we were well treated and well looked after. And he said to us, would we like to go to a shooting box in the jungle on the Sunday? And we said, well, yes, thank you very much. It'd be fascinating. So Les and I, sort of rather imagining something up in the trees in the jungle, we were rather surprised when the chauffeur-driven car turned up the next morning and took us some 40 miles along a beautiful tarmac road into the jungle to a brick house which would not have been out of its place in Surrey, with an open-air swimming pool and beautiful gardens. And as we went in through the front door, a bar with a barman standing behind it. And this was his shooting box in the jungle, and there were just the two of us to enjoy ourselves. This was the sort of life that we were finding ourselves getting accustomed to.
It was a good posting from the sound of it.
Yes.
What about the aircraft? You mentioned it was the Beechcraft
Expediter. The Beechcraft Expediter was a small, I suppose you could say, it was a bit like a Hudson on a small scale. It carried about six or eight passengers. It was an American aircraft with the usual full equipment and autopilots and everything else. Very comfortable to fly, and just ideal for a crew of two.
So even that was good news as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a joy to fly the aeroplane and to also to virtually go to every part of India. There were not many parts of India I didn't go to. Occasionally I would fly also as a co-pilot with the Dakotas. In fact, on one occasion I remember, the first load of Wrens had come out from the UK, and they were supposed to go to Headquarters Air Command, or rather to Lord Lewis Command, which had moved from Delhi to Ceylon. But owing to, again, the failure of communication, these 30 or 40 girls had all been sent to Delhi. And it was our job to ferry them down to Ceylon. And on the way down, I was flying as the co-pilot on the Dakota, but I was the senior officer. And we got engine trouble and had to land at, I don't know, maybe Hyderabad or Secunderabad or somewhere, for the aircraft to be, engine to be fixed, which meant having to do a night stop. So I had the problem of finding, having to find accommodation for 30 girls overnight. And eventually somebody was able to arrange for a local hotel to take them. And us, the two of us as well. We arrived at this hotel and everyone was accommodated quite happily. And I found myself suddenly being made very welcome by all kinds of young army officers and others, offered drinks and so on, who wanted to be introduced to one or other of the girls. Never have I felt so important. It was an uneventful visit, and they were delivered on time to Ceylon the next day.
What did you think of the Dakota? I know you're only co-pilot, but...
Well, the Dakotas we had were not normal Dakotas by any means. The Viceroy's Dakota was equipped in one way. The Commander-in-Chief's Dakota was equipped another way. Then we had one or two sort of semi-VIP Dakotas. I can tell you a very good anecdote of one of them, and that is that the occasion when Lady Mountbatten, who was the boss of the Red Cross or St. John's ambulance, was out visiting India. And she'd come to Delhi and was then going on to Ceylon to join Lord Louis. And she was the guest of the Viceroy and Lady Wavell. And it was our job to fly them down from Delhi to Ceylon in the Viceroy's aircraft. And the crew of the aircraft, Paddy Towle and his crew, had had a hell of a night out the night before and were very much, I wouldn't like to say incapable of flying, but they were not exactly on their best behaviour. And in those days, we didn't go through the palaver of all standing outside the aircraft and saluting when the passengers arrived. We were all inside the aircraft, ready to start the engines and so on. So Paddy Towle was up in the crew compartment with his crew, and they were more or less in their shirt sleeves and having quite an argument over something or other, and there was a terrible thud in the place. And Lady Wavell and Lady Mountbatten had arrived earlier than the Viceroy, and when they got out to the aircraft, Lady Wavell said to Lady Mountbatten, "You haven't met Wing Commander Towle and the crew, have you?" And she said, "No." Well, of course, Lady Wavell knew Paddy Towle very well. She said, "Well, I'll introduce you." So she takes Lady Mountbatten through and opens up the crew door to introduce them, and is met by these four people in their shirt sleeves with a terrible thug, all having a hell of a row. And it didn't exactly impress Lady Mountbatten.
Right, unless there's anything else, these are good stories. I don't know if you've got any
I'll
more.
Tell you one story that has never, ever been published, and a lot of people may say they don't believe it. In the early days of the Comms Squadron, they had Hudson aircraft. And the Viceroy's son, Archie Wavell, was his PA. And Archie wanted to get into the fighting and didn't want to just be his father's PA.